Welcome to The Jump. I am Rachel Nichols alongside my co-pilot here today, NBA reporter, ESPN LA radio host, the man does it all, George Sedano, and of course the Hall of Famer over there on the other side of your screen, Jackie McMullen. Malika Andrews is going to stop by later to talk more Nets. Coming up, we're also going to discuss the Celtics. Are they playing with enough urgency as the regular season winds down? Stick around for that. First, though, we start with some breaking news. LeBron James has been upgraded from out to questionable for tonight against the Kings, according to Adrian Wojnarowski. LeBron has been out since March 20th with a high ankle sprain. That is the longest absence of his career. And look who's coming to join us on the show. Welcome back, Adrian. It's nice to see you.
Good to see you guys.
Thank you, thank you. How likely do you think it is that we will actually see LeBron on the court tonight?
Yeah, there's a real chance, Rachel. LeBron James is going to test that ankle prior to tonight's game against the Kings in L.A. And I think he feels a real sense of urgency here. The Lakers have lost four or five games. Certainly they're in fifth place in the Western Conference. But he's going to go out tonight, test that ankle, see if he can give it a go against the Kings. If not tonight, however, you could expect he'll be back on Sunday against Toronto.
This is such an interesting question for the Lakers, for LeBron himself. We've seen teams with Pat, right, like the Nets, who are doing well in their conference. They're doing okay because they've got three superstars. They have given their stars longer to rest and recuperate after injuries. You mentioned the urgency there with LeBron and the Lakers. How do you feel that battle is going between making sure that it's just absolutely buttoned up, safe, that he will be back and healthy for the playoffs versus having to get yourself in good playoff position before the regular season even stops?
Yeah, Rachel, listen, we're in the window here where LeBron James was planning to return. It was going to be a matter of which game it was going to be. But I think the fact that the team has struggled lately, certainly, listen, he wants to play, and he has been out. This is the longest stretch of his career. But I'm told, listen, the one thing he wants to make sure doesn't happen, and certainly the Lakers do, is that there's not a re-aggravation of that high ankle sprain, that this is not something that is going to linger, and then, all of a sudden you have another injury, have something closer to the playoffs. But I think he's going to, again, test it out tonight, see how he feels. He's been very close, but tonight's game against the Kings could here mark his return to this Laker lineup.
So interesting, and really a question for everyone around the league with this condensed schedule. Guys who are coming back all of a sudden are coming back to a train going full speed ahead, and we'll see how LeBron does with it. Woj, thank you so much for joining us. We will
Thanks, Rich.
Later on. All right, now let's discuss another setback for Giannis and the Bucks. Just 46 seconds into last night's game, another injury. This time it was Giannis rolling what was already an injured ankle. He limped to the locker room before returning to the bench. Here's Coach Mike Budenholzer.
Just a sprain. I think we're hopeful that it's not serious. We'll see how he responds to treatment tonight, treatment tomorrow. Get an update at some point tomorrow. But I think we're hopeful that it's, obviously he couldn't play or finish. Not something significant or serious.
So, Jackie, this is kind of a continuation of the conversation I was just having with Woj, right? Someone has something a little bit wrong with them. They think they can go, and then all of a sudden they hurt themselves again. Giannis came into that game last night, probable, already nursing a right ankle sprain. Right. How concerning are these injuries to you?
Everything's concerning to me in this weird season, Rachel, because we already know the players are mentally exhausted, and I think there's evidence all over the place that they're now becoming physically exhausted. If I'm the Bucks, I'm going to exercise all sorts of caution here going forward with Giannis. Even if he tells me he's fine, I'm adding two more games, then I'm going to keep him out. They have 10 games left. They're not going to catch Brooklyn for the East crown. I don't think they're in a lot of danger of slipping below New York to the fourth spot. I'm not sure I would play Giannis at all the rest of the way, and I understand the danger of that because you want to have your team in sync and in rhythm as you get into the postseason. But Giannis, an unhealthy Giannis, forget about it for the Bucks. So I'm exercising all sorts of caution going forward here.
Rachel, if we were playing something, nothing, or everything, I would go something here, okay. Certainly, because there is a level of concern because the biggest predictor of future injury is past injury. Right. And not only is he nursing an ankle injury with his right leg from just a few weeks ago, but let's not forget the bubble, right, and how that transpired. This has been something that has been plaguing him for a while, right? So I do think that that needs to be something that is highlighted here in this situation. And it's so close to the playoffs starting. They're not going to be in the play-in situation, but obviously, so in 3 weeks, the playoffs start, the real playoffs start, right, beyond the play-in. And that's just not a lot of time when you're nursing an injury like this that continues to hamper him.
And I know people have made a lot over the last couple seasons that the Bucks have lost, I believe, their first playoff game both years, the last 2 years,
right,
to a number 8 seed. And, oh, gee, what's wrong with them? And this year they better go into the playoffs more ready. Guess what? They won both of those series very handily. So even if, Jackie, as you say, Giannis doesn't come back until the playoffs, even if they lose that first game, we have been shown that they have the ability to pull the series out without much effort. And look, it's not just re-injuring. We saw with Jamal Murray the other night, right? He had an injury on one side of his lower body, came back maybe a little early, right? He said he really was just so eager to play. He had to get back in there because we know Jamal and how competitive he is. And then, of course, compensation injury, it seems like, on the other side. So whether it's Giannis, whether it's LeBron, it's a lot that these superstars and their teams are balancing since, as you note, that's the whole ball game. If LeBron or Giannis is hurt for most of the playoffs, that is the end of the road for both of those teams. I want to move on to the Wolves. Green. They beat the Warriors last night by 12. Minnesota out-rebounded Golden State 57-34. After the game, Steve Kerr lamented his team's effort on the glass and called for a referendum on the art of the box out. Take a listen.
You know, what killed us was the rebounding. Obviously, we have a size disadvantage, but that doesn't account for the 16 offensive boards they had. I thought at least 7 or 8 times we didn't box out. Somebody came in from the weak side. We didn't hit them, and they got an extra possession out of it. And when that happens, it's almost impossible to win.
George, you've seen the Warriors up close several times this year. Do you understand Steve's frustration?
Certainly, I understand Steve's frustration for the entire season, to be honest with you. But in this particular case, I think he's right. And I think that this is part of a byproduct that we're seeing of teams wanting to increase their pace, Rachel, because the details, right, aren't necessarily there because everyone's like, I got to get out to my spot on offense. And it's like, oh, hey, wait, we got to secure the ball first, right? That plays into this particular situation. I would say this. Look, I covered for a long time those LeBron, Wade, Bosh teams who were undersized as well. Not comparing them to this Warriors team, but as far as a size is concerned, they didn't have as much, they don't have very much size just like this team doesn't. And they were told, hey, look, you guards, you forwards, everybody's got to go and rebound, and everybody's got to do the little things. And I think that with this particular Warriors team or any team that's undersized, that needs to be a point of emphasis.
I've been hoping for 3 years someone would bring this up. Because here's the thing about defensive boxing out. If you do it properly, it doesn't matter what size you are. The ball goes up, you turn, you make contact with your player, either with your arm or preferably with your rear end, and you take them off the glass. You can be 6'2" and do that to a 7-footer if you do it properly. Bam Adebayo is a good example of someone that boxes out. The Lopez brothers are good. You know, some of the bigs are good. Taj Gibson, who's not a huge guy, is a great guy at boxing out. But my goodness, everybody else turns and says, I'm athletic now. I can outjump everybody. Let me grab this ball. Not so much. I'm so glad Steve Kerr said this. This drives me crazy. Really does.
Steve is there to answer all of your basketball fundamental needs, Jackie.
Yes, he is.
Absolutely. Certainly this season with his Warriors are playing. All right, guys, everyone stick with us. We're going to discuss coming up if the Celtics are still playing with the same sense of urgency this season as they have in previous seasons. All right, let's turn our attention to the Celtics. Boston currently in the 6th spot out east. They share the same record as the Heat, so that's going to come down to some tie-breaking stuff if they stay neck and neck. Now, over the last 12 games, the Celtics have beaten teams with better records, but lost to some of the teams with worst records. Jackie, this is a team that was in the Eastern Conference Finals 3 of the last 4 years. Do you feel that experience is going to help them here, or is it kind of inversely giving some of their younger players a false sense of security that everything's just going to work out?
Honestly, Rachel, if you look back on Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, they got so much so soon, and obviously they had a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. But they also had a lot of veterans helping them along the way. Guys like Al Horford and Jay Crowder that were doing the little things, and later on that would have been Gordon Hayward as well. And so I do think there was a little bit false sense of, hey, maybe this isn't as hard as it looks. Well, here's the thing. You have to have urgency if you want to win in the NBA, and you have to put it out every single night. There's been, Jason Tatum's had 5 turnovers in the last 23 games, and he's a great young talent. I'm not saying you shouldn't build around him. I'd build around both these young guys. But look at this pass. You can't do that this late in the year when you know your team is scuffling and that there's issues with this. I've said all along, the day Gordon Hayward left, you lost one of your big, strong defensive wings that could help you with the three-point shooting. I'll tell you, last year in the whole NBA, team shot 33.4% against them, Rachel. That was best in the NBA. Mm. Look where they are now. Wow. Look at their defensive efficiency now. And to me, urgency, that's stuff like turnovers. That's stuff like defensive effort. And it's the less glamorous stuff that gets teams to the Eastern Conference Finals. And let's be honest, the Eastern Conference is much different this year than those previous years that you referenced. It's a lot tougher.
So I'm going to disagree with you ever so slightly, Jackie. While I agree with the general premise there, what I would say to you is this has been a failure of Danny Ainge in a lot of ways, because that depth you talk about is not there anymore, whether mm-hmm. it's Gordon Hayward, whether it's Jay Crowder, whether it's Al Horford. And you're putting more and more and more of the onus on these two young guys who are performing in big ways. Not to say that they don't have nights where they underperform or make mistakes that cost them games. But to me, this is about Danny Ainge. Okay, he hasn't replaced this team. This is a team that last year didn't have a ton of depth, and they came back with, I don't know, less depth this particular season. So I'm putting a lot of the blame on Danny Ainge for this particular team's performance.
Well, on that note, Jackie, when we saw the amount of money that Gordon Hayward signed with in Charlotte in the offseason, there was a lot of Gordon Hayward isn't worth that much. Are you kidding? $120 million? That's crazy. But it's always about what's a player worth to that team. It's not necessarily on the open market, right? And to the Hornets, he was worth that. They're not attracting a bunch of free agents. That money has to get spent somewhere, and spending it on Gordon Hayward obviously has really worked out for them with the way their season has gone. Do you think, in hindsight, Jackie, that Danny Ainge should have spent that same amount of money on Gordon Hayward, knowing that that was the competition with Charlotte?
I think that's a good question, Rachel, but I will tell you this, that Gordon Hayward was such a good soldier last year. He sacrificed shots, minutes. He was the best facilitator on the team. He did all the dirty work defensively. I think Gordon Hayward was ready for a change of scenery. I think he believes he can be a number one or two on a good team, and that wasn't going to be possible in Boston. So I'm not even sure the money was going to matter at this point. I think Gordon Hayward was just ready to move on, honestly.
Interesting. Well, it'll be interesting to see this offseason if Danny tries to adjust some of those holes that we have seen all over these past few months. Jackie, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll see you soon. Up next, our Nets reporter, Malika Andrews, is going to stop by to explain how first-year coach Steve Nash is managing that revolving door lineup of superstars. Keep it locked to The Jump. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Jump. So lovely to have Malika Andrews joining us now. Best bookshelf in television. I'm just going to say it. Malika, the Nets host the Blazers tonight. As you know, Kyrie Irving will return to the lineup after missing last night's game, and Kevin Durant is now going to sit on the back-to-back. We still have no idea when James Harden is going to return. What have you noticed, Malika, about how Steve Nash has managed this revolving door lineup?
Well, Rachel, right now they're kind of having no choice but to embrace it. When I talk to Steve Nash about what it has been like, he says over and over again that we have just come to embrace the unexpected, because that has been the story of their season all year long. And he actually talked about it ahead of the Pacers game and mentioned something that he said put everything into perspective for him. And that was Caris LeVert being diagnosed with cancer. Now, obviously, he is okay. It was a mass that they were able to remove. He is playing again. We are all thankful for that. But he actually said that even though he only was able to coach Caris for a short amount of time, that was something that was really impactful, because in the grand scheme of things, he said that he was a little bit frustrated. What keeps him up at night is knowing how many minutes, the backlog of minutes that other players have had to pick up in the absence of a Kevin Durant, a James Harden, other people like that. But that is what he was thinking about, Rachel.
You know, Rachel, Obviously, anyone who covered Steve Nash as a player probably realized he's as good a fit as there is to coach a team just because of his demeanor, right? Like, just he was a coach on the floor in many ways when he was with the Phoenix Suns. So there was an expectation that he'd be good at this. But he's exceeded those expectations because of everything Malika just outlined and what you outlined, which is this thing has been chaotic in a lot of ways, and it hasn't felt that way or as much. It hasn't felt as chaotic because of Steve Nash being so grounded, being able to kind of manage things and getting the best out of those guys on that roster that are not named Durant, Harden, and Irving.
Yeah, and look, his relationship with Kevin, I was thinking the other day just about how the Warriors days you would see after practice, right? Do you remember this, George? You would see that just Steve and Kevin working on the floor, having some of those shooting contests and things like that. I think that also carries through in this situation, Malika, when you have to have people in and out and this and that. Do you think him having a shorthand with Kevin, a shorthand relationship with some of the other guys that he's been at events with over recent years, has that helped him too?
Yeah, and also experience, Rachel. I absolutely think that you're right. That has helped, and that's an astute observation. But I also think that Steve Nash has said, sort of over the course of the year, he has grown and learned sort of how to be a coach, to take a little bit more authority, to figure out how to blend the I was a player and I know what you all are going through with also being now the authoritative figure. And that's something that came with time and with reps. But now at this point in the season, they're hitting sort of the right stride of those two things. Steve Nash has talked about the fact that he thinks he has figured out how to sort of protect these players from themselves, even in cases where Kevin Durant told me last night he wanted to play in this back-to-back. He thought maybe he lost some bargaining chips having to go back in the fourth quarter when their lead shrunk a little bit. Those sorts of decisions that Steve Nash is now making and making them with authority, that's also giving him sort of a leg up and making him kind of realize some of the moves that he has to make as a coach that potentially he hasn't had to make in the past, even though he's been around these players, and that's shaken out recently.
And let's not undersell the staff that he built, okay, that has a ton of experience, including specifically Mike D'Antoni, his old coach, right? Because I know that everyone likes to look at Mike D'Antoni and say, oh, he never won the big one. But, man, I don't know if there's a coach that came any closer to winning the big one or getting to the big one than Mike D'Antoni has. And I remember specifically when LeBron, Wade, and Bosh won their first championship, Rachel, Eric Spoelstra called Mike D'Antoni to tell him, hey, your style won, okay? So you need to take some solace in that. And I do think that we should recognize Mike D'Antoni being a part of this as well.
Yeah, that positionless basketball, right? Everything that he pushed. And I think the players on the team now, even if they didn't, I mean, guys are young now. Not everybody knows some of Mike's early work. But even if they didn't see it firsthand, they know that he's responsible for this evolution in the game, and that makes his voice a little bit louder. I remember at the beginning of the season, Steve was talking about how I was just trying to control everything and do it perfect and do it right. And he said it was about 2 weeks in that he realized that's not going to happen this season. So I should just surrender to the chaos.
Forever.
That strategy has really, really helped him. I want to get back to LeBron James. We talked about it with Woj at the top of the show. He's been upgraded from out to questionable for tonight against the Kings. LeBron has been out since March 20th, guys, but that high ankle sprain, it's the longest absence of his career. So, George, what changes for the Lakers with LeBron back in the lineup? Even when he's just working his way back in, what can he pick up and help them?
Again, if we were playing something, nothing, or everything, this would be everything,
this
Rachel.
Is everything.
Okay. Look, they've been the second worst offensive rating team in the NBA in his absence. Okay. In 20 or 21 games, whatever it's been, they've been really bad on offense. Okay. Even with Anthony Davis back, they've been a little better, but not as good as LeBron James. He is the engine here, certainly. So, right there, that fixes a lot of problems. And then, look, defensively, they've been good, but they have slipped a little bit. They went from being the best defense in the NBA to being the second best defense in the NBA to fourth. So there's been some slippage, and with LeBron back in the lineup and obviously AD, they could go back to being the top defense in the NBA as well.
Well, and what this affords, George, and you know this as well, Rachel, is that what the Nets are lacking right now, in some cases, is just definition of what is going to happen. There is so much unknown. And so when you have Andre Drummond having signed with the Lakers while LeBron James was not playing, you were able to see him and Anthony Davis a little bit. But then you add LeBron into the mix, and it's a question of, okay, how is that going to work exactly? Anthony Davis has talked about the fact that he enjoys playing the four. So when LeBron comes back, what shifts there? Is it still going to be Drummond playing the five. I know Anthony Davis has talked about how he envisions it being a little bit like DeAndre Jordan, Blake Griffin, Lob City Clippers. Those roles get to be solidified. They get to be refined. Even if LeBron James is on some sort of minutes restriction, all of those things they get to see, they get to work through, even with a couple of games back. And that's an advantage over a team that a lot of people think could be pushing them, and that is the Nets.
Yeah, absolutely. And also just lets people play their regular roles, right? Andre Drummond's role on this team is going to be different if LeBron James and Anthony Davis are in the lineup, and that's what they intend to have during the playoffs. So it will let him finally, for the first time since he's been here in Los Angeles, know what that role is and work through it. George, we did see AD and AD, as we've been calling them here, kind of have a lot of conversations over the first few games, who does what. We know that AD, of course, prefers to play the four so he doesn't get beat up all season, but that Frank is going to slip him into that five spot when he needs to. Second halves of playoff games, we've seen all kinds of things. And Anthony has been great about saying, that's fine, I get it. What do you see as sort of LeBron, Anthony Davis, Andre Drummond, all of that shaking out, George, as they chart this path for the playoffs?
So I think LeBron obviously just puts people in their roles, as Malika talked about. Like, I think Andre Drummond's offensive game, which has been pretty good, will be even better with someone like LeBron. Look, you give LeBron anyone that can roll to the rim, and it's going to be magic, right? Like, there's no doubt. But specifically with Andre Drummond and Anthony Davis, I'm curious to see how LeBron helps them defensively, right? LeBron is certainly going to help. I don't think there's any question about that. But it is small sample size theater here. 83 minutes with AD and AD, and it's a minus 12.6 net rating, okay? A 106 offensive rating, a 119 defensive rating. Oh. And I think that we saw this a little last year with Dwight Howard, where there were matchups where he could be played off the floor. But the difference here, Rachel and Malika, is this. Frank Vogel has talked about Andre Drummond being someone that will play starters' minutes. This isn't Dwight Howard, who is coming in to play a smaller role. So how does Frank Vogel adjust to that if this defensive struggle continues for them with those two on the floor?
Well, and it's going to be interesting to see how that affects everyone, right? So we're talking about, I love the AD and AD. I'm going to use that. I'm going to keep that. But it's like, okay, well, then what happens with Gasol, right? He has already expressed maybe a lack of enthusiasm over the current role that he's playing. So all of these dominoes, that's what I'm excited to sort of see shake out. And it hasn't been, right, a disastrous pairing, a disastrous coupling between AD and AD. It's been kind of interesting to see that shake out. But everything gets to be a little bit clearer now that LeBron James is in the mix. They can kind of start looking at, okay, how is this going to look in the playoffs? Because as George mentioned, we know that Anthony Davis took that role over in the playoffs, playing the five a little bit more. Is that going to be replicated where Andre Drummond is going to be playing maybe a more of a JaVale McGee type of role? Or, like you said, is he going to continue to be playing some of those starting minutes? So that's sort of what I am excited to see, because right now it's just all possibilities. When LeBron James comes back, that's when you start to see a really clear path of how these Lakers are going to look.
And one of the things that's so remarkable about LeBron, what he does himself, that would be enough, right? That would be enough to be a superstar in any discussion. But it's the way he activates other players, because of the way he can pass, because of the way he sees the floor. So you have to expect a bump from everybody else on that roster once he is out there and in rhythm again. That is certainly what Frank Vogel is hoping for. We will see how quickly it happens if that starts tonight against the Kings. All right, guys, coming up, our friend Ben Golliver from the Washington Post is going to join us to discuss his bubble ball book, diving deep inside the NBA's quest to save the 2020 season. Malika and I are going to have some bubble flashbacks. Stick around for that. First, though, here's what the Jump recommends for today. Mike Schmitz traveled all over Europe covering, quote, the world's most intriguing prospect. 7'2" teenager from France. He will be eligible for the 2023 draft, and I would not want to be approving Mike's expense report. But you can check that out on ESPN.com. We'll see you in a minute. All right, welcome back to The Jump. We are now thrilled to be joined by friend of the show and the author of Bubble Ball, Inside the NBA's Fight to Save a Season, Washington Post national NBA writer Ben Golliver. Welcome in. A little bubble reunion here with me and Malika.
Yeah, we're the alumni club. It feels great. Woo. Thanks for having me.
Do we get stickers, pins, T-shirts? We got to work that out after the show.
All the above.
Exactly. Ben, you've been covering the NBA since 2007. What was it about the 2020 season that motivated you to write your first book?
Well, to me, it just seemed like it was going to be one of the most important years in NBA history. When you look back at the Hong Kong controversy, Kobe Bryant's tragic death, the shutdown with the pandemic in March, and this incredible comeback plan to try to stage the Disney World. You add all that up, there was just so many layers to it. I mean, this is a basketball book first, but it's a political story because you have a presidential election campaign going on. It's a social justice activism story because of all the players' protests along the way. It's a public health story. And I think it's a business story, too. And we're talking about billions of dollars at stake.
Yeah, and look, inside the bubble, too, it was a superstar story, right? We had a couple larger-than-life figures that you really highlight throughout the book. I was so interested in how you talked about Jimmy Butler, LeBron James. How did you see those two huge forces of personality shape what was going on inside?
Well, the bubble was for the grinders. That's how I always saw it. I mean, it was day after day. I was there 93 days, and trust me, I was counting every single one. I know Malika was there longer than me, and she was counting, too. And I think it really came down to the guys who had the most competitive spirit. We saw all sorts of teams fold, the Philadelphia 76ers, Los Angeles Clippers, the Houston Rockets, but the Miami Heat didn't fold in large part because of Jimmy Butler. Mm. And I'll never forget in the NBA Finals when he keeps extending these series and everybody's hopping back on the media bus saying, hey, we're ready to go home. Well, one guy who wasn't ready to go home was Jimmy. And I think that you saw him just exhausted on the sideline after some of those games, 40-point triple-doubles. And it was really the peak moment of his career to date.
Yeah, and look, Malika, you were there for more than 100 days. And that idea, right, of that survival of the fittest, if you were inside the bubble, I think the coverage felt a little bit different from those of us inside than some of the people outside, especially when, say, Paul George was talking about mental health issues or the way some of the social justice issues, civil rights issues affected people when they were in that crucible environment. What moment stood out most to you now that we have, thankfully, a little distance from that experience?
Oh, man, it's hard to pick just one. I think, you know, listening to Ben talk and reading his book, I was thinking about Jimmy Butler when he was laying his hands over the stanchion on the sidelines, just looking utterly exhausted. I mean, that's how it felt for so many of us, because as Ben writes about, as he just talked about, it wasn't just the basketball that happened in the bubble. The things that stand out to me is everything else that was happening surrounding it, especially because, as you both know, when we first got down there, there weren't the words quarantine and social distancing and shelter in place and stay at home. All of those things hadn't quite sunk in yet, right? It was something that we were all still getting used to, this alternate reality. And so what stands out to me thinking about all of it is how much people had to put their own fears, their own thoughts about the unknown aside in order to go into the bubble and do their jobs, whether that was playing basketball, whether that was reporting, whether that was producing, whatever that was front and center in the bubble. And having to put all of those fears aside every single day to do a job, to provide entertainment, that's what's going to stick with me for a very, very long time. And I think Ben's right. I think the NBA for many, many years is going to be thought of in pre and post bubble terms.
Absolutely. Ben, one thing I really liked is that it's not just the big picture story of the NBA, all the big issues that you talk about, but some of the details about what it was like to actually live in that. Malika and I spent weeks trying to get a pizza. We could not get a pizza until they put it on the room service menu for like the final 2 weeks. Ordering a pizza to get it delivered inside the bubble required so many steps, and then when we finally got the pizza, we were not allowed to use a pizza cutter because that was not sanitized. Ben, what was the most sort of off-court kind of thing for you that stands out about things that you could or couldn't have in your daily life that you didn't even quite realize till you got down there and you were like, oh, I guess I will not have, in my case, pizza for several months?
Yeah, I want to stand up for all the players who said how hard it was, because when I was down there, I mean, I put on weight. My stress level, anxiety was way up. Being terribly, I felt the feelings of isolation, being 3,000 miles away from my parents and not being able to see them for more than a year. So it was absolutely challenging. I mean, I'm right there with you. I mean, I was so happy when I had my first pizza, but I kept getting this brown veggie meatloaf. I felt like it was like night after night. I kept getting it on the vegetarian menu. So I actually would just text pictures of that because it looked so disgusting to my friends, just to kind of mess with them and show them how rough we were living there in the bubble. But one thing I remember during the shutdown, when the Bucks actually had their protest, I remember there was nothing for the players to do for the first time in more than a month. Right. And there was a back parking lot totally empty. And I saw Kawhi Leonard just spinning circles in a golf cart like he was a 75-year-old retired, Central Florida resident, because, you know, he finally had a moment to himself and there was nothing he could do. He couldn't drive a car. He couldn't will walk down the road. And of course, this is a guy who takes helicopters to games, right? So it's a little bit of a different lifestyle, I think.
Malika, what was the off-court thing for you? And I'm just laying this out, the not important thing. We know what the big important things were, but stipulated with that, what was the thing, the little thing that you couldn't do because you were there that finally, after a few months, 3 months, you were like, okay, I can resume my life?
You guys don't understand. Like, the pizza was so incredibly
right?
important. We ordered it in.
Oh my
we
God.
Tried to keep it on ice for a couple of days. We tried to get it sent out to an outside hotel because they wouldn't cook it in their kitchen because they were worried it wasn't sanitary. Then we said, okay, fine. We had to sign a waiver that said that we would be okay with sending the pizza to another hotel to be cooked. The pizza comes back. Rachel goes to get a knife to cut the pizza, or actually a pizza cutter with which they didn't have, a knife, which they wouldn't give us. Nope. So Rachel is standing there trying to cut this pizza with one of the plastic flimsy knives. And I think you broke one of them.
I did.
Like, it wasn't. It,
I would not stop, though.
She was pressing down so hard,
forward.
It broke. So that.
There we go.
All of that situation, if we're talking silly, like, that was, I don't even know if I could fully enjoy the pizza because by the end, I was so angry with how the whole thing went down.
And shouts, as always, to our producer, Melinda Adams, who quarterbacked what turned out to be one of our most complicated
Absolutely.
Achievements in the bubble, getting a pizza. Ben, I just want to show everyone this picture. It's a great photo of you after the Lakers celebration, completely drenched in champagne. It was a celebration not just for the team that won, but I think everyone, the reporters, the NBA staff. I don't think it gets said enough how much there are NBA officials who were there longer than any of us on this panel. They were there from literally day minus 10, and they came out and really worked through the whole way. So shout out to them as well. Okay, everybody, not only go get Bubble Ball. I see Malika with her copy right there, available anywhere you buy your books.
This,
also, Ben has a great podcast, Greatest of All Talk, or GOAT, with our friend Andrew Sharp. So go listen, and you can find him there, too. Ben, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
Excellent. Everyone else, stick with us. Up next, the Suns and Jazz facing off with first place on the line. Which team do you trust more? We'll discuss that. Nikola Jokic taking on Paul George and the Clippers. You know, I sat down with Nikola ahead of this game. Our full conversation is going to be on the Jump Monday ahead of Nuggets Lakers, which is going to be a huge rumble for seeding in the West. But here he is talking about life after Jamal Murray. Take a listen.
You guys really seemed on track to be right there in title contention this year. I know that is your biggest goal. And then Jamal Murray goes down.
Yeah.
What goes through your head after the initial just being concerned for your friend about what it's going to do to the rest of your season?
It's hard, you know, because I really miss him. He's someone he's really, like, he's competing. He's really competitive. He's like dog on the floor. It's not going to be pretty. No, it's not going to be nice, but as long as we have the win. I think the only way we can do it is together. It's fun when you play together, when you pass the ball, when you shoot the ball, when you're playing for each other, you know, then the whole team is happy.
It really has been just remarkable how that team has not missed a beat since Jamal has gone down. And obviously, we expect it to be different in the playoffs. It's a different kind of game, and not having that scoring presence is going to matter. But I do think it has strengthened Nikola Jokic's MVP case that after Murray went down, they've been able to keep pace here. And these two games on ESPN, the game against the Clippers, the game against the Lakers, just so huge for them. I'm very excited to see how it goes. All right, guys, time for our League Pass game of the night. We've got 8 games on the NBA slate, including a great doubleheader on NBA TV. But this was probably the easiest decision for our producers in the history of the Jump, because the Suns face the Jazz tonight. First place in the West on the line. Utah has held the top seed in the West for 87 straight days. But if Phoenix wins, they snap that streak because they hold the tiebreaker. So, George, which team do you trust more in this showdown?
Now, while this might have been the easiest decision for the Jump staff to pick this as the League Pass game of the night, this is also one of the toughest questions I've ever gotten here. Okay?
Yeah.
Are great, okay?
I think we're hearing George through my microphone because this is live television. Yeah. No, it's all good. Malika, why don't you jump in here? Who do you trust
more? This is Sophie's choice.
Mm-hmm.
Even with his mic turned off, I could hear the pain in his voice.
Exactly.
This is Sophie's choice. And I say this, like, closing my eyes, clenching my fists, not even, like, I just, the momentum the Suns have right now is so impressive to me. And I do not want to vote against Chris Paul right now. I just, There's something about it. I like it. I like his surge in the MVP conversation. Suns, I like it. I like it for the Suns.
What about you, George?
My mic works now.
Hey, look at
so
that.
So there's that.
There's
sorry
that.
About that. So anyway.
Say it loud, say it proud.
If Chris Paul and the Suns are the one seed, he's my MVP, okay? Ah. It's just that simple.
Wow.
There has not been anyone who's made a bigger impact, I think, this year than Chris Paul. This team hadn't made the playoffs since 2010, Rachel and Malika.
Well, this goes back to that interesting question, right? Are you deciding MVP on straight stats, right? Or are you deciding on, quote, value to the team? When do those two things overlap? Why do you think Chris Paul deserves right. that more in that category, George, than when you look at the stats, say, that Nikola Jokic has?
Because the Suns have stunk, basically, for the better part of a decade, and they have a very similar roster to what they've had. They're not a very deep team, to be honest with you, but Chris Paul has made this thing work. From a leadership perspective, he's given them accountability. He's made those young guys accountable. And defensively, they're a much better team than they've been in recent years.
Malika?
Right. Well, it is mind-blowing to me to look at a body of work like Chris Paul's and to know that he has not won an MVP. That's what I will say on that one.
We will see how it all goes tonight. Stay tuned. The Jump will be back on Monday.